You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
we have incredible leaders in the military, and we have incredible military, and we are very proud of them. And this was another very, very successful mission.
And the world's media gets more excited about the dropping of one large bomb on an Islamic State target than it has about the thousands of somewhat smaller ones previously dropped on similar. My guests Carlotta Ribello, Ben Ryland, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Ree Sheridan will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the increasing closeness and weirdness of France's presidential election, the unfurling of an extremely long list of Brazil's bent politicians, and the Eurovision Song Contest becomes once again, war by other means. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Carlotta Ribello, Ben Ryland, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Ree Sheridan, four people with nothing better to do with their Good Friday. Welcome all to the program. And we will start tonight with the United States, where the same people who didn't care when President Barack Obama dropped lots of bombs on Islamic State are now complaining because President Donald Trump dropped one, and the same people who decried President Obama's expenditure of American military resources in unwinnable foreign wars are applauding President Trump for expanding America's involvement in same. At issue is the first battlefield deployment of the GBU-43-B massive ordnance air blast bomb, known to excitable tabloid editors and almost visibly engorged Fox News hosts as the mother of all bombs. Carlotta, first of all, it was dropped on an Islamic State tunnel complex in Nangarhar province, or with the usual caveat, so we are being told. We only have the word of the United States and the Afghan Defense Ministry for this. But the Afghan Defense Ministry says 36 militants dead, base destroyed, no civilian casualties. Now, that sounds kind of like a success, doesn't it?
It does. But for me, what is baffling about this whole story is the cost of this device in the end. You know, this is the U.S. military largest non-nuclear explosive device, cost around $16 million. And that means that by killing 36 Islamic State militants is around $450,000 per person, which is a significant higher cost than any of the previous strikes.
I do always wonder about metrics like that. You probably could argue that if you just offered the 36 guys $300,000 each, they probably all would have gone home.
Yeah, we can always argue that, and we'll never know now. Maybe we need to move on to the other 36. But, I mean, there's a reason why this hasn't been used before. You know, it's kind of a white elephant of U.S. military devices. And, you know, it was developed for the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and it hasn't been used until now. So, yeah, it was kind of a success. There were no civilian casualties. But was it worth it?
Henry, I'm going basically clockwise around the table here. Is the media doing a poor job here in associating this device or the deployment of it so closely with Donald Trump? Because as far as it's possible to tell, the decision to drop it was actually made by General John Nicholson, the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, and it followed 2 days of regular airstrikes on more or less the same target, which he believed were not getting the job done.
Well, I think from what I've read, they're doing quite a bad job of deciphering this device in general. I think that they're not necessarily to blame for that. The acronym is too delicious to resist, isn't it?
The Mother of All Bombs acronym is not the official. It is the MOAB officially stands for Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb.
Of course. But, you know, it's good copy nonetheless when you take its informal acronym. I'm not sure if an individual use of this device necessarily means anything in and of itself. I mean, you know, it's been employed in a theatre of combat, apparently appropriately. You know, it's a big bomb. It's delivered by a plane, which is easily targeted. You can only really use it in areas which aren't very built up and they don't have much surface-to-air defence capabilities. This was that exact situation. They used it apparently to the effect that they wanted. There's something to suggest that the only reason it hasn't been used before is because the circumstances parties weren't right, not because the president was less gung-ho.
It is weird that we have forgotten, as the Western world's media, that the mother of all phrase was, of course, originally coined by Saddam Hussein, who promised America the mother of all battles prior to the invasion in two... Was it the first Gulf War or the second? One of those two. Ben Ryland, do we think this would be getting half the coverage it is getting if this had happened on Barack Obama's watch? Again, it is forgotten that on a few occasions last year, Barack Obama either ordered or signed off on the deployment of B-52s over Afghanistan, which carry a vastly larger payload than the single MOAB.
It does have a bit of a stench of branding exercise about it. I don't want to be too cynical about that, but it's unfortunate that it does carry that with it. No, I don't think it would have got the same level of coverage, basically because it probably wouldn't have had that same copy attached to it had Barack Obama dropped this sort of bomber. The style of Barack Obama's intervention in Afghanistan within Islamic State territory never carried this sort of strongman chest beating sort of feeling that Donald Trump has really built his entire campaign around. And let's not forget that as president, he is still running a campaign. He just happens to have already won it. So it's unfortunate that it does carry that with it. But no, to answer your question, I don't think it would have been the same at all.
Barack Obama, it's certainly true, didn't seem to go in nearly as much for the somewhat grotesque and undignified high-fiving which has followed this one. Fernando, do you detect, or do we detect here, I guess, an echo of the previous week's missile strike on Syria, i.e. a spectacular military operation launched without an apparent coherent strategy underpinning or following it?
I think there's no strategy at all. And to be honest, I'm very surprised, you know, about, you know, this bomb and the Syria airstrike. Because let's remember when Trump was campaigning for president, he was supposed to be the isolationist. He was not going to intervene in the Middle East. That was the role of Hillary Clinton. So to be honest,
he also wasn't going to waste time playing golf, which he is now doing, I think, for the 17th time in his presidency.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it's a cliche to say this, but we can expect anything, you know, and there's other countries, even China warned that, you know, that there might be a war between the US and North Korea at any time. So, you know, he's unpredictable and, you know, it's a cliche, but true. Huh?
And that's part of his strength, isn't it? The part of his strength is that he is unpredictable. So his battle to win the daily PR war means that he must remain unpredictable. As soon as the media starts being able to tell what he stands for and who he is, that would equal weakness in his eyes.
Well, but his unpredictability has consequences. We need to remember that this strike happens just, you know, as he's preparing to dispatch his first high-level delegation to Kabul. You know, Afghanistan is a country that has 9,000 and odd American troops there, and the lack of strategy paired up with that unpredictability can prove really dangerous for those that are still on the ground.
He might reasonably argue, however, I guess, or it might be reasonably argued that the United States has had 16 years now nearly of what were supposed to be coherent strategies in Afghanistan, and 16 years later they still can't quite get out of it. On that happy thought, we should look across now towards France, which is a little over a week away from the first round of voting in its presidential election. If polls are to be believed, it has tightened to a four-horse race. While most people believe that the Front National's Marine Le Pen will make it to the two-person runoff on May 7th, anybody who bet their mortgage on such an outcome will be getting nervous. In particular, a surge in support for the far-left firebrand Jean-Luc Mélenchon has upset most people. Previous calculations. I'm going to go counterclockwise around the table this time. Fernando, are we tempting fate if we allow ourselves to just enjoy the thought, enjoy the possibility that, contrary to all previous expectation, Marine Le Pen comes down at the first hurdle and doesn't actually make it to the second round?
I have to be honest with you. I think she actually has almost a guaranteed place in the second round. I think the biggest danger
you're
here...
No fun. I was trying to cheer everybody up.
Yes.
Very soon.
I'm sorry, but actually I think the biggest danger here is that Mélenchon will go to the second round with her. You know, I think it's still early days, you know, there's still like a week to go in the campaign, but that would be quite an interesting thought, and I bet that's what the markets and don't want as well.
Well, interesting is one way of putting it, and you mentioned the markets, which had sort of tanked in roughly proportionate degree to every increase in Mélenchon's polling numbers. Because, Ben, is that the nightmare scenario, that eventually the runoff is between Marine Le Pen and Jean-Luc Mélenchon, by nightmare scenario, I mean, is that what Marine Le Pen would most prefer?
It does feel like a nightmare scenario, doesn't it? But only a short while ago, we might have said that about Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. So, I mean, it's an interesting situation. I don't think that that's actually where it's headed, though. It does really point in the direction of Macron facing off against Le Pen, and I can imagine that happening. What frightens me is that even given those choices, that France might actually choose Le Pen, and then, of course, we end up with no more European Union. And that, to me, feels like the most frightening scenario at the moment. Whether this surge for Mélenchon actually results in anything, I don't know. I'm sorry.
Henry Rhys Sheridan, the scenario that Ben mentions there, the confrontation on May 7th between Marine Le Pen and what was his name again? It's completely vanished.
Macron.
On Marsh Bloke. That's the one, Macron. See, this is what happens when you have four candidates in an election. This would, of course, be seen by most as a rerun of the two-person runoff, I think, in 2003, when Marine Le Pen's father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, ended up running against Chirac, and France was sort of decorated with posters urging voters to choose the crook, not the fascist. Is that the most likely outcome, do you think? And would that be preferable to that bizarre runoff, which it would be between Mélenchon and Le Pen, where you would have a choice between two populists who both want to take France out of the European Union?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, very tempting to try to find both historical parallels, but also set up kind of quite neat dichotomies between, you know, the two different candidates. As you mentioned, I think Mélenchon and Le Pen actually have probably more in common in terms of particularly their stances towards international institutions than some people might want to believe.
If I may add something as well about Mélenchon, I mean, all the other candidates are actually attacking him quite heavily in the last 2 days or so. I think this might have an effect in the next series of polls. You know, I think Fillon, Macron even kind of joked when I was young he was a socialist senator. So it's still quite interesting. So perhaps Mélenchon's wave might not be that big.
Well, it certainly points to them believing the hype, doesn't it? And perhaps believing that he is a bit of a danger. But the other danger that I would fear as well is that if Macron were to actually ultimately win and become president, what does that actually do to all of the surge in support that Le Pen is enjoying at the moment? They don't just go away, you know. They don't just look at Macron and go, oh, well, he's the president now, let's move on. Something happens to all of that rage. And is Macron necessarily equipped to quell all of that outrage that has resulted in this massive far-right-wing surge? I mean, it's sort of a situation when you imagine in the US, if Hillary Clinton had actually persevered over Donald Trump, it sort of points to a situation in 4 years that might actually be far worse. What if all of that rage that pushed Donald Trump into the White House were actually to become something even worse, and we don't know what that would mean and how bad that might actually be?
Carlotta, returning to the French election, do we, in the context of this particular election, are we overestimating the power and influence that the next president of France may actually be able to have? Because we are in the curious position that, at least before the next French parliamentary elections, of the three of the four front runners have two members of the French parliament between them, and those are two Front National members. We could, if Macron or Mélenchon become the president of France, we would have a president with literally no representation in parliament.
Yeah, but then it would shake things up ahead of the next election. Well, I think what's a danger here is that if indeed candidates that want France to leave the European Union, persevere and become president, you know, there's a whole, you know, we're in the midst of the Brexit negotiations, and that is going to have an impact. Of course, it's not going to be immediate, and we don't know if they go down the same route and go through a referendum, if whatever is going to be the result. But it's definitely going to shake up the confidence on the European institutions at a moment that it most needs its support. And also, another point here on the elections, I think, you know, it's the question that we keep asking ourselves, I think, every week. How is Fillon still in the run?
It is amazing. It is genuinely
amazing.
Extraordinary.
But it raises an important question, which is, if he dropped out, where would those 19 points where would those people go? Who would they vote for? Because a lot of them wouldn't go to Macron. And then you fall into a gap. Who would they vote for? And what would happen if Fillon drops out? And I'm not sure that would be the best option. We want to believe that that would mean everyone would rally it up and do the patriotic thing and do everything to stop Marine Le Pen of becoming president. But would that actually happen?
Well, that's part of this strange paradox that we've opened up to recently, especially in French politics, is that the sides of politics aren't so clear anymore. There doesn't seem to be the clear view of this person is the conservative, this person is the liberal. Marine Le Pen on the far right, we describe her as being on the far right, and historically, the far right has been terrifying to the LGBT community. She's actively courting the gay vote, and she's actually getting a lot of support in the gay community, perhaps not widespread, but there are a lot of people who are actually siding with Marine Le Pen. And it's, to me, it's very, very confusing, but it does speak to this strange sort of place that we're in. And even the Secretary General Nicolas Bay of the National Front, he actually said this is not actually an election about right or left. It's about patriotism versus globalization. That's how he's painting this election, and he may actually be right about that.
Before we move on to other things in the second half of the show, Carlotta, we have a foreign desk live event pertaining to the French elections coming up.
Exactly. On the 11th of May, so that's a Thursday, we're doing a foreign desk live here at Midori House. We're looking at what France's election, the result, would mean for the world. This is after the first and second rounds. So far, we have confirmed the London's bureau chief for AFP, Florence Biederman, a regular here on Monocle 24, and also Jonathan Fenby, and another regular voice here on the French coverage that we've been having. That is in the evening of Thursday, the 11th of May. After the debate, we'll have some drinks and hopefully a spirited discussion. And you can buy the tickets at monocle.com.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Carlotta Ribello, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Ben Ryland, and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Coming up next, Brazil's corruption scandal manages to just about surprise those who thought they were past being surprised.
Monocle's style special sets a striking tone for the spring-summer season, including a countdown of the shops, stylists and tailors worth keeping an eye on. Outlandish outfits mark our expo, where our culture editor Robert Bound meets a colourful cast of characters at Southeast Asia's hottest festival, Wonderfruit. A different kind of look is examined in affairs as we dive headlong into the field with Sweden's soldiers. And in entertaining, it's off to Germany to meet the culinary world's freshest new talent, the Thermomix. Issue 102 of Monocle, on newsstands now.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Carlotta Ribello, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Ben Ryland, and Henry Rhys Sheridan. And we will look now at Brazil, where the corruption scandal, which has been roiling the country's politics for years, has long since passed the point at which it would seem like a bigger story if it was discovered that some or other office holder was not on the take. Even so, this week's release by a judge of a list of dozens of politicians he intends to investigate was startling. It included nearly a third of the current cabinet, dozens of members of Congress, and the former mayor of Rio. I did chuckle there. I do realise this isn't funny. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our resident Brazilian, the thing that strikes me about this, and we've talked about this scandal a lot now for what seems like centuries, or the thing that always intrigues me is, why isn't there more popular outrage, civil disobedience, etc., etc.? Because this does seem like the final confirmation that a political class is more or less entirely rotten. I mean, this is, I do commend listeners to looking up the entire list, because it goes on for so long, it does acquire a certain comedic value. It's like that visual setup of the guy treading on lots of rakes. It just eventually gets to a point at which it becomes funnier and funnier and funnier. But why is there not more popular outrage about this?
Well, I have two reasons for that. First of all, Brazilians have been protesting since 2013, so there's a little bit of a fatigue. I mean, even President Dilma was impeached, especially after this series of protests. But I have to be honest with you, you as well, Andrew. In 2013, I was very surprised to see Brazilians in the streets, because historically, it's not Brazilians, they don't usually protest that much. I mean, there's been some moments, but we're not like the French or the Argentinians itself. So it's interesting that, you know, we see these accusations. Basically, all of our politicians, more or less, are involved, including five former presidents. But I don't see protests being arranged in the streets.
Is it possible that reluctance to protest is kind of part of the problem, if you will? Not obviously that political corruption is unheard of in places like France and Argentina, but this is extraordinary. You would think in most other countries that I can think of, if a tenth of this was true, then surely the president's position would be untenable. How can he possibly stay where he is? A third of his cabinet are on the hook for corruption charges.
It is shocking, and it's interesting because President Temer released a video yesterday defending, because he's also on this list, accused of bribery. It was a one-minute video, and I have to say cringe-worthy, because he said the accusations were repulsive. But he's actually not really defending. He was not explaining why he was on this list. So it is actually quite embarrassing. Because, you know, for example, you see in countries like even like South Korea, where President Park, you know, she's in jail at the moment as well. It is very embarrassing, the situation of Brazil at the moment.
I love this front page from a Metro from São Paulo on the day after the list was released. So this is a front page that the Metro newspaper, which is given for free around the country. They mimicked the lineup of the Coachella music festival.
Yes.
And instead of dividing it by days, they divided the lineup by category. So you have ministers, and those are, you know, big headline, the big names, then governors, still a bit relevant, and they move on to senators, federal MPs, and then still others. There's still that category.
These are the ones in the tent up the back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The tent at the back that you go after 6 a.m. and a lot of drinks. And they replace the image at the bottom about the festival with a picture of the Supreme Court. So I think well done for Metro. Probably the best front page I've seen on this. But it just goes to illustrate how long this list is. 108 names. A list that has been long waited for since the previous judge attached to this case died in a plane crash last year. So it's good to see that when these names come out, at least someone was able to have a bit of fun with it.
Sorry, I've got a question for Faye quickly, which was, did Brazilians know that this kind of corruption was going on before this investigation?
And that's the thing. So people might ask, like, did it reveal anything? And I think it did, because now you're putting the name of the person and the accusation. Because before you just had an idea, oh, this person could be on this list, but this list was not revealed to the public. But now we know the names, so we have to wait and see the reaction. But so far, you know, I didn't see any major protests in the streets.
But I wonder, was it kind of considered normal that level of corruption was going on? Was there an understanding that there was a kind of ambient corruption in Brazilian politics? Because I wonder, it seems like the population is caught between corruption's normalization, but the necessity for outrage, because now it's been, as you say, you know, pinned on to particular individual politicians.
Essentially, the outrage doesn't happen because people have known about it for so long, and now just because you make it official doesn't mean I'm going to get suddenly angry about it.
No, absolutely. And I have to say, even though I think it's very relevant, but I am not that shocked as well.
Okay, well, finally tonight to what is clearly the day's big story, and we do look at Russia, where life has rarely been easy. However, in a rare moment of respite from its centuries of hardship, its people will at least be spared this year's Eurovision Song Contest. Following the decision by the host Ukraine to disbar the Russian entry, Julia Samolova, for having visited Russian-occupied Crimea in 2014, Russian broadcaster Channel One has announced that it will not be broadcasting the annual warbling tournament. Fernando, as our Eurovision desk chief, which is your role here at Monocle 24, how important is this? How damaged is the credibility of Eurovision 2017 by this?
I think it's very damaged, in my opinion, because I think this is the first time that a contestant cannot go to a country for political reasons, in a way. And you know, cool, we can have some fun with it, but I think the event will be poorer without Russia. Let's remember
well,
that...
It'll at least be quicker. You mean, you've got to give it that.
It will be quicker, but let's remember Russia is a big country, the viewership. I mean, if Russians cannot, will not be able to see the show as well.
Will Russians be able to vote?
I don't think so for the moment.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that's good news for the Ukrainians right there, isn't
yes.
it?
No, and can I be honest with you? I still have hopes that the situation might change in the next 3 weeks, that Russia might be allowed again. But, you know, we have to wait and see, because I know the EBU, they were very angry with the decision that
they
Russia
were.
Would not
they,
be
they,
as
they,
well.
Well, their complaint was, and I'll pass this off to Ben Ryland, who I'm going to anoint as our deputy Eurovision deputy chief. The European Broadcasting Union was against the ban. And I love the reason for this. They accused Ukraine of politicizing Eurovision. It's always political. It's the only reason to watch it. It's the thinly veiled nationalist hatred sublimated in the choruses of vapid pop songs. It's the great joy of the event.
Look, I love Eurovision. I do love Eurovision. However, I have to have a bit of a chuckle at the EBU here, because I don't think Ukraine was really thinking about Eurovision when they banned this particular person. I mean, let's be honest. This is quite a bit bigger than Eurovision. Ukraine is talking about an individual who had done some sort of some dealings, let's call them dealings, in an area that, you know, has it's quite public that's a no-go. If you've conducted in this sort of business activity in a contested part, I mean, it's not even contested. Crimea belonged to Ukraine, and it was taken over. So, you know, this gets into all sorts of geopolitics. It doesn't really relate to Eurovision that much, and I think relating it back to Eurovision sort of, it really turns the whole thing into a bit of a gimmick, because I don't think that's what's going on between Russia and Ukraine when we talk about Eurovision. It's a much, much bigger deal, and I just feel like the whole thing is just a bit of fluff. Everyone will keep watching Eurovision. Everyone will still take part except for that one person. How unfortunate. But, you know, Australia's in there now, so the numbers are still there.
Carlotta Ribello, Assistant Deputy Eurovision Desk Chief.
Thank you. I was about to say that things were... There's still, when this ban happened, we're still reeling back from last year's Eurovision, when the winner, Jamala, caused quite a stir between Moscow and Ukraine as well, because of the theme of the song and everything else. So I think that coming from that, and then this contestant that had visited Crimea, I'm not sure if it was that unexpected. And I love how we always say, and the EBU certainly says it more often than we at our Eurovision desk do, which is do not politicize Eurovision. But even the banning of the Welsh flags, was that last year or 2 years ago? It's always been political, and it will always be. And it's still quite charming how naive the whole thing remains.
Henry Rhys Sheridan, Deputy Assistant Deputy Eurovision Desk Chief.
I'm glad you said that. I have nothing to contribute to this conversation. I just wanted to know what my title was. So you preempted my question.
But seriously, do you feel that the credibility of 2017 Eurovision is somehow forever tainted by this standoff?
I don't know enough about it to be able to say the way, and I definitely don't care. One thing that I would be interested in hearing from Faye is whether any of the possible solutions in the notes section of my script may in fact solve this issue. So it says here that she might be able to perform via satellite
Fernando shaking his head. Is this a non-runner?
It's
not happening.
For the contestant to be changed, Fernando.
I don't think either will happen. I mean, it's a question of proudness as well. I think Russia should say, okay, if they don't accept our contestant, we're not going to make another one for you. But my personal opinion is actually, I understand, you know, it is a crime in Ukraine for a Russian artist to perform in Crimea. But I think Ukraine should have taken the moral high ground and say, okay, we make an exception for this international event.
But if they had made the exception just for this instance, that would have been even more political, wouldn't it?
Well, this is a discussion that I can assure listeners will rage long into the night here at Midori House, but that is all we have time for the radio incarnation thereof. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexa Sogol. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. More music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie, and there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Enjoy the rest of your Easter weekend. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.